Welcome back to Ben and Matt's Marvelous Journey. This is an MCU podcast. We are looking at everything from the year of 2022 in the year 2023. My name is Matt. I'm joined by Ben, and this is episode 40, Werewolf by Night. Ben, it got spooky last year. Hollywood's worst kept secret. People were talking about this thing, I feel, at least a year before it came out.
I can't remember when we started hearing about it, because obviously, like, there were all kinds of rumors that, like, Marvel are going to do a Halloween special in 2022. Mm-hmm. It will release, and then, like, we're like, Michael Giacchino's directing it. It stars Gael Garcia Bernal. Like, here's all the information. Like, it's going to be filmed in the style of, like, a Hammer horror movie and all the rest of it. And everyone's like, okay, cool. And then the weeks and months went by and nothing was mentioned. And it's announced at Comic-Con, isn't it?
They officially acknowledged it, like, a month before. Was it D23?
Oh, maybe it was D23.
I think it was part of their slate of, like, you know, acknowledging there would be a Captain America 4, and, like, here's a trailer for Werewolf by Night, and it's out next week, and or 2 weeks from now, or something. And yeah, so something to say up front is that, like, this is a character that is a deep cut, even for, like, Marvel sickos. Like, I wouldn't ever try and be like, I know more than, like, anyone about Marvel. Like, I am Mr. Marvel, but, like, I know a fair bit. And I had never even heard of Werewolf by Night, because he's not a character that pops up super frequently in this day and age. However, you know, as we've touched on in, like, episodes on Shang-Chi, the 70s were a different time for Marvel. We had blaxploitation, we had kung fu, we had horror. And I believe, Benjamin, if we want to just go straight to Comic Corner, that is where we find one Jack Russell.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at this. So the Marvel Wikia has 177 credited appearances to Jack Russell, who is the Werewolf by Night, who's introduced in a Marvel Spotlight series. And they do, like, a 3-issue kind of horror story about a werewolf. And horror is obviously part of the bread and butter of comics. Like, basically, like, the superhero genre kind of booms into life in the 1930s with your Supermans and your Batmans, and is kind of hot shit in the 30s and 40s. We all know that Marvel gets into it with Captain America in the 1940s, and you've got, like, the Submariner and the Human Torch and all these really, really early characters who were all also kind of, by technicality, war comics at the same time. Like, they're kind of like even Superman is fighting Nazis and stuff like that, whilst also doing the normal Superman
and
stuff.
And you got GIs passing comics around while at war and stuff like that.
Yes, exactly. And then superhero comics kind of go away. Batman and Superman don't, because Batman and Superman kind of, like, cement themselves in the culture, as does Wonder Woman. But, like, Marvel definitely are on the downswing in terms of superhero comics. And a lot of what makes up the publishing imprint around that in the 1950s and whatnot is romance and horror are kind of the two things. Even Marvel, when you go back to those very first Marvel comics that feature the superheroes, quite often what they are is horror comics, or in, like, horror, like, here's a 5-page kind of, like, spooky story that's kind of, like, telling the story of this person who designed a machine to speak to ants and stuff like that. And they're not really superhero comics in the way that we think of them now. But horror was definitely a huge thing. That's where you get, like, EC comics, the kind of thing that Rob Zemeckis used to kind of, like, play around with. When you think of Tales of the Crypt Keeper, like, that is very much riffing on this kind of era of horror comics. But as all things are cyclical, superheroes come back on force in the 1960s, and it's basically all that Marvel publish for a decade.
Is some of that because of the comic book code cracking down on horror?
It is very much that, where, like, this goes away. And I mean, it's always fun when people go back to, like, that horror era. Did you play What Remains of Edith Finch? You did, like, because there's that one part of that game that's told in the style of, like, an old EC comic story. Which is just a lot of fun. But, like, that is very much what, like, people who were, like, particularly kind of, like, your baby boomers, like, coming up in their teen years, they are really running rampant in this era of of horror comics, and quite often when you hear, again, like Rob Zemeckis is a big one, like he is someone with huge 1950s nostalgia built into him because that is when he was a teenager, and when he thinks of comic books, that is what he his like model of all this stuff is. But yeah, comic book code comes in, everything kind of gets a little bit neutered, and so you end up with the 60s being Marvel doing the stuff we all know about. The Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Miracle Run, or Fantastic Four, like Thor and X-Men, and just every single Marvel character that is the foundation of their entire publishing empire. And then, I don't know what it is that kind of comes around, but in the 1970s, there is a sudden surge of a very different kind of comic that's coming out. And it feels like the first generation of Marvel writers is kind of going away. Like, it's not quite just the house of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko at this point. You're moving on to second writers and third writers on X-Men, on an Avengers and stuff like that. And kind of unfairly, I feel, the 70s for Marvel is kind of pinned to this is the decade of the X-Men. Like, mm-hmm. X-Men, giant-size X-Men, comes out in 1975, and basically that is the focal point of almost anything that you'll read about Marvel for kind of that 15 years. Like, 1975 to, like, 1991 is the heyday of Chris Claremont X-Men, and it's I mean, you've read the stories about this time and all the rest of it, and there's so often like entire chapters devoted to the behind the scenes going on X-Men and how X-Men is kind of propping up the entire house of ideas at this point. But Marvel are getting weird behind the scenes, and we've discussed it where they're being a little bit reactive, because it is very much like, well, what are they doing? They're doing Blaxploitation comics with Luke Cage. They're doing Kung Fu riffs with Iron Fist and with Shang-Chi. And I think I have to assume this is kind of the surge in the 1970s of kind of like television show, of Hammer horror, and also like late night horror classics on TV that I feel like really, really come to the fore in the 1970s. But there's a massive, massive, massive surgence of horror stories again, like a little bit softer horror stories, but like this is the decade that is the introduction to Man-Thing, to Morbius the Living Vampire, to Werewolf by Night as we're speaking here, to Blade, to Ghost Rider, to all of these characters, and quite a lot of them do hang around, but they're all a little bit more spooky, a little bit more related to the devil, and a little bit more related to kind of like things that go bump in the night. This is the era that when you get to the 2000s, when they're saying we're going to make these movies, everyone's like, oh yeah, we're going to make R-rated movies about Ghost Rider, about Blade, about all these different things.
Yeah, and they were planning a Werewolf by Night movie in 2001, which is radical when to consider that years before we got Iron Man or the MCU, or, you know, reel off as many known characters as you want, Werewolf by Night was there first, and they just let it go cold eventually. And, you know, there's rumors of like Kevin Smith wanting to use him in
Kevin Smith. They were going to build up to that, like the combination of all the shows like MODOK and Hitmonkey and all these different shows are going to cross over into a final thing. And he was like, oh, can I use Werewolf by Night? Can I use Man Thing? And they were like, no.
Because we're doing it.
We're doing something in the MCU. You can get the characters you don't care about in the MCU. Yeah. So, I mean, which probably speaks volumes about how late into Ant-Man and the Wasp they decided they were using MODOK.
Indeed. God, yeah. And, yeah, I mean, so a long story short is that is a character that kind of goes away for a while. And, like, his legacy to me is that's where Moon Knight comes from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from reading up on Moon Knight and reading some Moon Knight and stuff like that. And, you know, we were talking before we started recording, he pops up in Daredevil very briefly and stuff like that. But, you know, not a guy that is front and center, not somebody where you have to pretend you know exactly who he is, because it is kind of a niche character.
Yeah,
and
like, he shows up in things like, I mean, what, the list of appearances he picks, like Spider-Woman, West Coast Avengers, Doctor Strange, Morbius, he's on the Midnight Suns, he's in the Legion of Monsters, but these are not things that, like, the mainstream comics readers are, like, really into. This is the kind of stuff where, like, some writer who grew up in the 1970s will come in and do a single issue where they'll go, like, wouldn't it be fun if I brought back this character from my childhood? But, like, we all know the characters that hit from this era are Blade and Ghost Rider in terms of them being published, and that's because they kind of quite seamlessly fit into 1980s, 1990s kind of edgelord comics. It's the ones that, like, a little bit more action-packed, a little bit more brutal.
Yeah.
And then kind of it's later on when Bendis is writing the Avengers in the 2000s that he's like, oh, I can resurrect Iron Fist and Luke Cage as, like, 1970s characters. But no one has ever done the rehabilitation thing on Werewolf by Night because, I mean, the name is kind of dumb.
Yep. Yes.
I think it's fair to say.
I think part of that, like, contributed to the whole, wait, what? What are they doing? Because it's also, the other thing to note is it is the first of what ostensibly are going to be many specials, as they've called them.
We say many.
Well, I'm saying, you know, it seems like it's going to be a thing they will do more of. Like, they had a little opening, a special opening title card made for their specials. If they were just going to do two, I don't think they would bother doing
that. No, I don't think they will do two, but I do think there is an important thing to say here is that they did two last year, but there is a very definite rumbling of throttling down on direct Disney Plus content.
Yeah.
That feels like it's simmering based on, like, the delays in projects that we've got from this year where we're kind of, I think at the start of the series, we were like, yeah, we might get, like, Secret Invasion, Loki Season 2, and Ironheart this year. And now there's even question mark on, is Ironheart going to release in 2023? Is it just going to be a year of the three movies we've known about, even with the Marvels being delayed kind of 5 months, and we just get Secret Invasion and Loki Season 2 since those are the two that have had sizzle reels?
And the show we don't talk about, What If Season 2. But
yeah.
I mean, there are these rumblings. They want to finally listen to people and cut back on how much they're putting out. But I actually think that would be a shame on this front because I think these are such a good idea. To take your characters that would not justify a whole movie, that would not justify a whole TV show, but you can do something fun with them, get in and out in 30 to 40 minutes, and it's completely self-contained. There's really very little exposition given in this thing. No origin story for Jack or Elsa. And perhaps we should dip back to Comic Corner for Elsa, but I don't know. but yeah, like, and I should just say up front, like, I am smitten with this thing. I know you are, like, positive, but less enthusiastically so than me. And I just, when they released this, I was like, cool, can you do a lot more of this and a lot fewer TV shows, please?
My main worry with this is this what they're going to do with, like, obviously they followed this up with Guardians of the Galaxy, the holiday special.
Yeah.
Which we're not going to do a dedicated episode for, because it's very slight, and it feels like it makes more sense to just slot it into a Volume 3 discussion next year.
Yeah.
Even on this episode, it's too tonally kind of, like, weird to discuss this as one episode.
We talked about doing, like, a specials double bill roundup, whatever, but then it's like, what if one year they do three or five or one or whatever? Like, so I think we're just going to take them as they come. I think this one merits discussion. I think Guardians does not, really. Like, we can give it 5 minutes in when we do Volume 3 at some point in the future. But, yeah, I definitely Guardians was a bit of a bummer after, like, how positive I was about this as a concept. But, like, I do still believe there are characters that you could just do 35 minutes, 40 minutes on. Here they are. And then you could easily do a Midnight Suns movie where Jack, Elsa, and Ted, Man-Thing, all rock up and are part of that. And it would be fine. And you could probably soft reintroduce them because, I mean, you didn't really explain who they are in this, so you could just have somebody say out loud who they are, kind of thing. My response to them having so much shit was, what if you turn some of these, like, 500 TV shows into specials and, like, even if it's bad, I would rather sit down and watch something bad for half an hour than for, like, 8 weeks.
This just feels like it's such a weird thing where, like, this special in particular is so divorced from anything else that they're doing in the MCU at the moment, unless you want to say that, like, Moonlight and Blade are kind of, like, setting up this supernatural corner of everything. But, like, it feels like they probably want to do something big in this corner at some point based on, like, what projects they're doing. But, like, it's kind of two sets in total, really. It's filmed in black and white, which I have to imagine does wonders for making this look a little bit more high-end than it probably really is. Like, you probably can cut some corners in terms of it.
But it was actually filmed in colour and they converted it in post, which was surprising to me because one of my points was, look at this compared to the black and white scene in Thor. I think it's just down to it being better lit and framed, and so the black and white does it more favors. No, I hear what you're saying, and just
I just can't imagine like Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special is all filmed on sets that they already made for Volume 3.
Oh, yeah.
I can't imagine them going like, yeah, I know we're working on the Nova TV show. Can we convert Nova into a special? It's like, I feel like you need the special effects budget of something a bit bigger to do a Nova any justice.
Potentially. That's their problem with space in general, though. Like you can draw people flying through space and it looks dope, but like when you have to actually translate that, it's like, ugh.
And then Wonder Man feels like it's threatening to be playing in the same realm as She-Hulk kind of thing, as like a meta, humorous kind of like look at superhero genre, which again, like, if to do that justice, maybe you do need to do multiple episodes, but then your positivity around this is definitely well suited, because this feels like it has an idea, it gets in, executes it, and then gets out within 50 minutes.
Yeah,
like, it's really kind of remarkable that it does. And most of my issues with it come from, I wish it committed a little bit more to being a Hammer horror thing.
Really? Okay.
Like, just in terms of, like, I wish there was, like, more canted angles. I wish it, like...
They have cue marks, Benjamin.
This is true. And then the other thing is, it's still really, really slight. And I'm like, I don't know if this...
I think it's night and day with Guardians in terms of, like, how slight it is. Because, like, there are potential consequences that come out the back of this thing. Whereas the Guardians, it's like, they have a little sing-song with Kevin Bacon and everything's fine. I mean, you know... revealing that Mantis is Peter's sister, I guess, could be a thing, but like,
that was a deleted scene from Volume 2 anyway, so it's just it's information that has existed since movie came out.
Yeah, but I mean, this could potentially serve as a soft prelude to a future thing, and like establishing a, you know, you talked about it, that like it felt like in a very aimless Phase 4 one thing they were doing was sort of staffing up, as it were, like building teams quietly. Like with every project, it's like, ah, there's a young kid who could be a young Avenger, or ah, here's a spoopy boy, he could be a Midnight Sun, and so on and so forth. Like, you know, you've got Blade, you've got the Black Knight, you've got Moon Knight, you could have Doctor Strange in there if you don't think he's too big of a star to share the limelight.
I mean, I think we all need to discuss the definitive version of the team is the team from the video game, which of course features everyone's favourite spooky characters such as Iron Man, Hulk, Captain America, Wolverine, Spider-Man.
I was also sceptical about that, but they make it a whole thing where it's like the actual Midnight Suns don't get on well with the Avengers, and you, the player character, have to make these two teams cooperate. It kind of works. That game kind of rules.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm sure it's a good game. I've not played it yet. It is just quite funny that when that trailer came out...
I know. When they're like, here are 13 characters, and none of them are like Moon Knight or Doctor Doom or like loads of spooky people are left on their
people
table.
People who use magic in the MCU. Yeah, yeah. No. I mean, like, we obviously know there's obviously more characters like this that are coming, and obviously they're cut off from being able to use Morbius, who is a very significant member of the Midnight Suns. He's 1970s vampire character. Yeah. It obviously makes sense for why he would be. And like, there's been rumblings that they're going to do a Ghost Rider at some point in something.
They have to. Ghost Rider is one of those characters that, like the Silver Surfer, people who have no general overall interest in comics are like, yeah, Silver Surfer fucking rules, and it's the same with Ghost Rider. Like,
it's just that question of, like, who do they dip into? Like, is the first time we see Ghost Rider going to be Nicolas Cage's back, or is it going to be even more obscure? And, like, the Ghost Rider from the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. version played by Gabriel Luna. He's back. He's back himself. I mean, but then Gabriel Luna, like, he's had a really good career since he was an Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Like, he's on The Last of Us now. Yeah. He is the villain of Terminator Dark Fate. Like, he is no longer...
I think they are currently in the comics very wedded to Robbie Reyes, who has a sick-ass muscle car as the Ghost Rider. Like, every kind of use of Ghost Rider is him. But, like, I know Feige loves to go back to basics and origins and stuff, so, like, do you pass up on Johnny Blaze with his sick hog? I would go wild and see if you can get Nicolas Cage to play Johnny Blaze, like, mentoring Robbie Reyes, but maybe he wouldn't do it. But he made two of those fucking things because he loves Ghost Rider so much.
Say,
so.
I will say, like, completely on tangent, because I do want to recommend some comics off the back of this. If you want to go see some of the best art in comic books, I would recommend the Robbie Reyes initial run of All New Ghost Rider, which is drawn by Tradmore, who is someone who I absolutely adore in this space. Like, it's like not a great run, but like it's nice that he stuck around. But like the design is really, really notable, and the comic just looks like, gorgeous.
It looks great. That's the thing, and I think it modernizes and diversifies and everything. So
yeah.
I would go that way, but
yeah. So also speaking of Tradmore, like Doctor Strange: Fall Sunrise is absolutely fucking incredible. One of the best looking books ever. If you want a Doctor Strange book, like Oliver Sava, who used to write for AV Club, did a whole piece on his Patreon about like how gorgeous that Doctor Strange book is. It's like probably the first Doctor Strange book that's actually playing in the same vein of like the Steve Ditko, like let's take acid and read this comic book kind of thing.
Put on our black light and read Silver Surfer for a bit.
Yes, exactly. like 100% recommended. But yeah, Midnight Suns definitely feels like it's being teased. It is a shame that like we've got Blade, but like it feels like you can't, like Midnight Suns, like Magic and Nico both feel like slam dunk members you can't really do now. At least where the MCU is at the moment, and it's like
it feels like
especially because both have been adapted in the last like 5 years outside of the MCU proper.
Yeah, it feels like maybe the Midnight Suns are going to have to wait until post Kang. Like here they are, they're out there, but we won't bring them together until after all this is dealt with, kind of thing. But
yeah,
I mean that Blade movie is just not fucking happening, is it?
Well, I mean, like, that we know that there's a new director who's on board now. It's just whether or not, like, Mahershala Ali is apparently going to be happy with the script for this thing. Because I think he's... Mm-hmm. I mean, at least we know he's professional. But his experience with the MCU so far has been the fake MCU that was on Netflix that was being done by the television side, where he only had to show up for 6 episodes and not in the new vein of movies where like the scripts aren't finished and you go into shooting without knowing what Act 3 is. So we shall see if a 2-time Oscar winner has the sway to actually like turn this into a good project.
You would hope.
I mean, I it's a slam dunk casting for him. Yeah. It would be great to have him lead a corner of the MCU that is maybe more kind of like stripped down. Like, let's make these things for $60 million and have them be kind of, like, a little bit grimy, a little bit dirty. Like,
well, so, I mean, that's the thing. Like, for me, as I said, I'm smitten with it. I think it is doing so many things that Marvel either don't do at all or have gotten away from doing. Helpfully enough, just to date when we're recording this, I feel the last week, the latest Marvel discourse has been sharing the ending of the first Captain America and how these things used to look like movies. And I saw somebody say, commenting on the radio, when was the last time in a Marvel movie an actor was reacting to a physical object that was definitely in the room with them? And I was watching this and I was like, this? Like, this is I mean, it's a set, but you know, I understand the location. I understand where everything is. They are reacting. They are using the geography of the space to fight and to traverse and all of this. It is not just he's actually just on a green screen and we'll put it all in later. Like Elsa is climbing the set and stuff like that, and a vague attempt at choreography and fight choreography with, you know, Elsa is doing some Black Widow style takedowns, and you know, my favorite little moment when she rolls into that little sunken bed to retrieve a crossbow, which by the by is attached to somebody's severed hand, and then rolls back out to shoot him. And it's just, this is stuff they are just simply not doing, where, like, it has been so long since any Marvel thing looked like it took place in a real goddamn place, other than just the same fucking street they use every time, and, you know, their pretensies, like, magical realms and stuff. Like, it's, for that alone, I applaud it. I applaud that it's just brief and stylized and gets in and out, as we said, and just gets going, and...
I think when I say that this movie doesn't quite go far enough, what I'm thinking of is, like, I want this to look like the Edgar Wright trailer for Don't from the Grindhouse movies. I want it to feel like that, where it's like, like, you know, like, it looks cheaper than it is, because I do think this movie, like, especially when Man-Thing shows up, it's like, oh, this thing's got a budget. And I'm not saying you need to make Man-Thing look like it's a guy in a suit, because I don't think...
Well, it is a guy in a suit. They then just slapped a bunch of CGI on top of it, and that was actually surprising to hear. I was like, oh, they would no way have a guy in a suit. I also learned that the Moon Knight costume is a real suit. It just looks like shit. Anyway, yeah, no, I agree. I wish it looked a little bit more like cheap-ass horror kind of thing.
I mean, because I watched a very long movie last year called Le Floor, which the whole point of it is it's kind of like it's four or five individual chapters, kind of like all filmed in a different style and whatnot. And the first one of those is a very obvious take on exactly this kind of era of horror, where it's like, it's a B movie, they find a mummy, and the mummy's going to like put a curse on them and stuff like that. And my big issue with that entire section of the movie was like, why is it not filmed like a B movie? Like, it's filmed the exact same way that every other chapter of the movie is, because it's what the director's style was. And this is closer to it than Le Floor was, but it's still like, I want just a touch, just a tiny touch more than what you're giving me.
I think
it does look great. It like, I do like the black and white photography. I do think, like, I like the cheapness of the way that it kind of, like, the sets look. Like, it looks fake in an appealing way, which is different to, like, how the Quantum Realm looks in Quantum Mania, where it's like, it's kind of fake in an unappealing way.
Like, the maze kind of looks like it could be a miniature or something. It's probably actually CG, but then elements of the maze are definitely real or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's nice that, like, you recognize, like, certain locations in it where, like, it's very obvious they've only got, like, three individual sections of this built, and they're just running through it from different angles and moving, like,
pot the corridor. And yeah. I just think if you compare this to the problem they've had with WandaVision and other things where they're like trying to riff on something and they're not really getting that close, I think this is getting way closer than any of that stuff is.
100%. I think that is the biggest thing to it, and it is just a shame that, like, my big issue is like, just 5% 5% more, and I think you've really, really got something here. And then the other thing, which is, I think everyone in this is really fun. I like Gael Garcia Bernal's really fun. Laura Donnelly's really fun. Harriet Sampson Harris, like, coming back from her fantastic supporting performance in Licorice Pizza, is really fun.
I like all the other hunters.
Yes. Yeah. Really fun designs. I text you whilst I was rewatching this the other night, and I was like, what is...
Does he actually have 100 kills or not?
Yeah,
like, I think he does. I think,
like,
he...
Does Ulysses know that he's a werewolf and is fine with it because he only kills bad monsters? Has he taken the place of another hunter? Like, does he actually... Like, does he only hunt when he's a werewolf but has somehow trained himself to only hunt monsters? It's just like there's this big black hole at the center of the characterization of this movie that, like, having this be a hunter contest where it feels like he's a legitimate entrant... kind of just leaves me a little bit confused about whether or not, like, is there intentionality to what he's doing, or is it, like, a massive mistake and he's like, yeah, I'm here because
I think it's more just
take credit for these kills.
I think he kills monsters. I think he probably has killed people by accident, and I think he doesn't revel in what he does, but he does factually have 100 monster kills or whatever. And has a medallion, and maybe Ulysses knew, but Verusa does not. I don't know. I don't think it matters. I think it plays into his characterization where, like, he almost looks like he's wearing, like, a priest's outfit.
Yes.
I think it's a suit. Like, he has a tie, which I couldn't make out what the pattern is on it. I was trying to pause and, like, see what the pattern on this tie was, but, like, you know, between his, like, ancestral makeup and, like, the way his suit or costume looks, like, I just read it as, like, he is just dousing this character in Catholic guilt combined with what I like to call dog acting, where he scratches behind his ear in a certain way, and he walks around in a circle before sitting down, and he can smell the blood on Joven's hands and stuff, you know.
Same school of acting as Channing Tatum in Jupiter Ascending.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
No, I think it's more just around when he is fighting as Jack before he becomes a werewolf, he is not very good.
He doesn't really fight. He avoids. He when he comes upon Elsa, he's like, I think we should just pass each other by. When Joven attacks them both, he kind of just fucking skips out and lets her attack him. Yeah, he is there to free the Man-Thing who Verissa has attached the Bloodstone to, which inhibits Man-Thing's powers. Whichever hunter takes down the Man-Thing and claims the stone gets to be immortal. Elsa is the reluctant, you know, she is the estranged daughter of Ulysses. Verissa hates her, she has a right to enter, and Jack is our sort of mysterious, sympathetic lead character, and they are the nice two. They bond, I love them sort of sitting down and talking in the mausoleum. And yeah, like, so it's very simple. Like, he is just there to get Man-Thing, who he knows as Ted, out. Elsa wants the stone, therefore let's team up. You can have the stone, me and him will leave. But he is, of course, turned into the werewolf by the Bloodstone, so...
Shall we do Comic Book Corner on...
Elsa.
Theodore Ted Salas. Oh, okay. And Elsa Bloodstone.
Sure, I mean, should preface it by saying, like, I've literally been begging them to put Elsa in the MCU for a very long time.
Yeah, was she number one on your list?
She wasn't number one, but she was in there.
I now want to look enter the real world.
Don't look at it.
Characters who should join the MCU.
Don't look at my accidental racism. So I've got Hercules. I think Hercules might have been number one.
Elsa's number 10, who's there. Captain Britain, not yet. Spider-Woman is in... This is the Madam Web movie, sure. So tick on her. The Sentry is coming.
Uh-huh.
Moondragon and Phyla-Vell.
Probably
not yet. Namor is here. We've got Namor.
Yeah.
Angela, we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
Nova is in the Crux bin cast, but it's not Richard Rider Nova. It'll be the kid version, most likely. And Brett Goldstein as Hercules. So, like, a lot of your list.
I got most of them. And it just goes to show, like, I mean, the news that Namor was actually definitely in Black Panther came quite late, because I was asking for Namor, and that feels like forever ago that we knew that Namor was coming. Yes, I just like Elsa Bloodstone, but yeah, why don't you tell us about her?
Elsa is a character, one of the relatively new characters on this list, very similar to America Chavez, where she debuts in a miniseries written by the saviors of the Guardians of the Galaxy, Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning, in 2001. She is the son of a kind of like of Ulysses Bloodstone, who's been showing up for a while at this point. Again, he's introduced in the 1970s, in the same kind of like, I think he actually debuts in the same comic that Marvel Presents, which is kind of like a ability for them to kind of do little short stories and stuff like that. It didn't run that super long, but they introduce her as the daughter of this character who's about 25 years old at this point, and explicitly. Elsa Bloodstone is a Buffy the Vampire Slayer riff, because this is at peak Buffy mania. She is a young, blonde female monster hunter, but importantly, she's British, which is what makes this incredibly ironic, in that the person who they cast to play Elsa Bloodstone in this TV show is, of course, the lead of Joss Whedon's The Nevers, which is his latest... I'm not even going to call it a television find, because she's been around for a while. She's on Outlander. She's the lead in like Britannia, I believe. Mm-hmm. So like, this isn't a certified Joss Whedon like stamp of approval find. It's him coasting off someone else. But she was the lead of a Joss Whedon television show.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a full circle moment right there. However, I do need to implore all of you, anyone who is listening to this right now, stop listening to this, because this is it's not going to be as good. I need you to go read Next Wave, like, immediately. I know Warren Ellis is problematic as all hell, but Next Wave is one of the most incredible 12-issue runs of comics that you will find. It is hilarious. It is, it's the kind of thing that I wish Marvel would have the balls to adapt into a movie. I don't think they could possibly do it. I don't think they could do it justice, but, like, the image of Elsa that is on the Wikipedia page and like almost everywhere is from Stuart Immonen's drawing of her in Next Wave, where she is a swearing, gun-toting huntress. And it's so good. It's so funny. Please go read that book.
Yeah.
And that's the most important thing she's ever been in. She kind of like one of the characters who like shows up every so often in a bunch of stuff. Like, she'll show up in like things where there's like supernatural things happening. I think she was on like the Fearless Defenders, which was the all female kind of spooky adjacent girl team that they did for a while. So again, it's similar to Werewolf by Night, like not a character who's had like a super long run where she's a solo character, but slots well into a team and slots well into spooky horror things that happen every so often.
She's a ladette, she kills monsters, she loves like packing a couple of shotguns, that kind of shit, and yeah, she's just fun, and they need fun. Laura Donnelly, obviously, I mean, she keeps the element of like, it's not really, I think of Elsa as having more of a youthful defiance, I guess, in that Buffy sort of vein, where she goes more with like, she's just weary, you're like, fuck off, mate, kind of thing.
It is interesting that obviously Laura Donnelly is in her 40s at this point, so it's like, it's definitely not the kind of casting they'd be making where like the people they've been putting investments into is like, here's Iman, here's Florence Pugh, here's
we don't need 10 things with Elsa in them.
But... No, I'm not saying that, but it is interesting where like, it very obviously is not going to be, she is not the lead of the MCU, but it's a fun casting choice. Yeah. She's really good in this role. I hope we see more Elsa. I hope we see more comedic, sweary Elsa in the future, but
I think the way this ends with like her inheriting the mansion and the stone and like, you know, she is a seasoned monster hunter kind of thing, I think it sets her up quite well to presumably be a like key pillar of the spooky corner, where Jack could almost be her like almost quiet, mild-mannered bud, where she is like trading barbs with Oscar Isaac and Benedict Cumberbatch and Mahershala Ali, and yeah, I hope she comes back. I mean, it isn't quite the Elsa that I was expecting, but I'm just really happy the character's here, and I do like what she did with it. I think putting the transformation scene on her reacting to it and the silhouette of him changing kind of thing, I think that was a good choice, and I needed to believe that she was afraid despite all the shit she'd seen kind of thing, and I think that worked really well. And then there's Ted.
And there's Ted. Man thing.
A confusing origin. Like, I was trying to look into this, like, which one is a ripoff of the other out of Swamp Thing and Man Thing.
But they're both kind of made by the same person.
Like, who were living together. No, yeah. Well, I mean, the people who wrote the first issues were living together. Yes. And, like, the first issue of one comes out first, and then, like, the first issue of the other comes out, and then the... I think it was the, like...
Yeah, so Man-Thing and Swamp-Thing are very similar in terms of their concept. Obviously, Len Wein is the creator of Swamp-Thing, and then he was Jerry Conway's roommate, who is one of the four credited creators on Man-Thing, which is Stanley, Roy Thomas, Jerry Conway, and Gray Morrow. And they were, and obviously, the thing with Swamp-Thing is, the Swamp-Thing that everyone knows and likes doesn't even come fully formed until you get to the 1980s when Alan Moore takes over.
Yeah.
But these two characters are kind of like side by side for quite a while, like both kind of like creatures from, like, riffing on Creature from the Black Lagoon almost in a lot of ways, kind of like eco friendly kind of like horror
adjacent. I represent comics. The planet, I'm going to kill all humans kind of
thing. Steve Gerber, best known for creating Howard the Duck, is well known for a run on Man Thing. Again, never a character that kind of like really pops off. Like, that's the thing, is like, this is a safe haven for characters who have at one point run a comic but never really have done enough to kind of like necessitate a full run.
I think you are far more likely to have seen Man-Thing pop up over the years than you are the other two here, because he is useful for like a big event comic.
Yes, quite often, like, if you want to foreshadow that something big is happening, you'll include Man-Thing in like a splash page and be like, oh, something has gone wrong with the planet's ecosystem, and therefore, like, it is rebelling in some way.
He's got his like nexus of reality and all this sort of stuff, hasn't he?
Yeah, I can't. There's definitely one comic book event that he's in the last couple of years where like the entire page is like built around his face. I remember this distinctly, and I cannot remember what the comic book is.
He's got his little Cthulhu-esque jowls, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Whereas Swamp Thing's just got more of a normal face kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's also funny that both Man Thing and Swamp Thing have like very cheap versions of a movie done kind of like at some point. Like Man Thing, the movie came out in 2005. I have to assume it was when these rights are being sold off to like really shitty things in the run of Marvel is bankrupt.
Yes. So fun. I can never remind people enough that Marvel were fucking in the dirt before they relaunched everything and became this almost insufferable juggernaut.
I mean, there was literally an article the other day which was like, an analyst has said that the best way for Marvel to regain the solo character rights to Hulk and to Namor is for them to give Comcast Hulu in exchange for those character rights back, because they cannot release a theatrical Hulk movie or a theatrical Namor movie.
Aren't there rumors that they're getting Hulk back, though? Or, like, maybe they're getting around it by calling it World War Hulk, and it's like an ensemble Hulk movie instead of a solo Hulk movie.
Yeah, it might end up being like Avengers Hulk or something. Like, that will be how they get around it. But, like, I mean, if they're doing the stuff that they're doing here, and again, like the rumors of who certain people are playing in Thunderbolts is true, then maybe they are building up to this, but God knows it doesn't fit for the character at the state where he is right now, because we haven't had an actual like Hulk on a Rampage movie now in
He got a little bit too popular with kids years. Is the problem. Like, I distinctly remember my colleague, the place I used to work, he took his kids to see Avengers and they had to leave in the middle of it because his kid was so afraid of Hulk. And he was, like, bummed because, like, he really wanted to watch Avengers. And they went again, and then he was like, oh, now Hulk's his favourite character. Like, he made it through the scary bit, and now he loves Hulk. And I think that Hulk's popularity with kids has pushed him in this way where he... There's a very... I mean, you're getting a bit of it here with Ted, and you get it with Groot, where it's, like, giant hulking thing that, like, says cutesy or funny things kind of thing. And like, the Ted stuff feels like it's riffing off of Groot, but, like, the most Hulk has been around for fucking forever. Enormously popular. Most of his comics suck. The most popular one in recent times is the one where they're like, let's make him a fucking horror show. Like, let's make the Hulk a supernatural, like, oh my god, it's the Hulk kind of thing.
Yeah, again, written and drawn in such a way where it looks like the old EC comics from the 1950s and stuff like that. Yeah. So it's like, very explicitly that. It's just weird. I don't know if I brought it up on the She-Hulk episode or not, but like, the size discrepancy between Abomination and Hulk in that show is kind of bonkers. And it's like, I know it's a conscious decision where like current Hulk Banner, where he's like at peace with himself, is kind of like sized down. He's still big, but he's like,
I told you all, I told you all in Endgame that Smart Hulk was a bad concept. Anyway, so the man thing they're going for here, like, you know, they've softened him, he's a big teddy bear if you're his friend. Teddy bear. if you're his friend. His powers, isn't it? He only burns you if you have fear in your heart or something like that.
It's one of those ones. On the Wikipedia, we have...
oh, God, no.
Superhuman strength, durability and stamina, empathetic senses, chlorokinetic regeneration, size alteration, corrosive chemical secretion, teleportation, portal creation, fear empowerment, reality guardianship, and plant manipulation.
I think that fear empowerment thing is tied to it. Because, like, you see, he squeezes Jovan's head and burns it to nothing. And then at the end, he grabs Verusa both hands and just chucks her across the room and she's dead. Like, but I think if he touches characters that do not have fear in their heart, then it's fine. But yeah, like, I don't hate it. It's just, it's not my fave, the way I don't know what I would do instead, but like, I guess I don't love this whole, like, subversion of the monster thing that happens all the time. I guess it goes hand in hand with, you know, they're building a spooky corner, and part of the point of this is that not all monsters are bad, kind of.
So if the plot of Blade turned out to be he's hunting Werewolf by Night and Ted...
yes.
Would that disappoint you, or would you want Blade to be...
Is that a thing that is on the table?
I don't know if it's a thing that's... I'm just saying, like, if you made this...
No, and
the thing we're begging for is more of these Marvel projects to matter within kind of, like, a year of them debuting, like...
Sure. I guess that would be hypocritical of me, to be like, it's cool that they just show up and then we never see them again. But nothing's teased at the end here with a new character or anything.
I don't think it's hypocritical. I think there someone was posting the other day about people's issues with the MCU and how they're like, you can't dislike Thor and dislike Ant-Man for the opposite reasons, where Thor feels like it's not setting anything up and is completely standalone, and Ant-Man feels like it's setting up too much. And I'm like, I want...
actually, it turns out. I'm very powerful that way.
What I want is I want standalone stories that feel consequential to their characters, I guess, is kind of like where I'm coming to. Whereas I don't want the plot of something to be nakedly setting up a future project at the expense of like the thing I'm actually there for. And I want the solo projects to matter to the characters' forward progression rather than feel like this weird, as we said at the end of Thor, Thor feels like he's progressed nowhere by the end of... He's just found his family that actually wants to be with him by the end of that movie.
I felt narratively satisfied by Werewolf by Night. I feel all the characters had their own little journey, as small as it is, and I'm cool with those people just being there until they want to pick them back up. And I think, especially with the horror corner, it makes sense to like say, oh, they're all out there, they all go bump in the night, but like most people never see them. I mean, the werewolf of it all, like, he does transform. I'm not in love with the costume or the look. I think werewolves are hard. I've been watching Buffy, and the way they did werewolves fucking sucked. But I do really appreciate the way that he is a fucking hurricane of violence once he turns into the werewolf.
I think the issue is that, like, you're always... If you're doing this kind of style thing, you're always going back to that 1950s Hammer horror kind of look. Uh-huh. And then... If you're going to go full horror, then you're doing American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
And, like, we all know what that transformation sequence looks like.
Sure. Yeah, as I say, I like that, you know, they naively think they can keep him contained. Of course he busts out. He fucking murders everything in sight. You know, this thing is more violent than Marvel normally gets to be.
There's blood in places.
Yeah.
Limbs get taken off.
He rips someone's throat out and the blood splatters onto the camera, kind of like that. You know, Elsa does that thing where, like, there's a sword in the floor and she pulls one of the hunter's heads down into it kind of thing. And she embeds a sword in the head of one of the other hunters. It's like, oh, wow, okay. You know, it's not, like...
It's kind of feels like this is the pitch where, like, maybe you can just about get this to be a PG-13, but like this is where you kind of want Blade to end up, really. Like, not let's not go, like, if you don't go hard R, then maybe this kind of like middle ground.
You can do extreme harm to non-human things, I believe, are the rules, because that's why in all the cartoons like Wolverine is shredding Sentinels, because you can't just have him gutting humans in every episode. And you can do like unspeakable things to robots and aliens and shit like that, but
they just can't have red blood and stuff like that.
Exactly.
Which is why Morbius is after plasma in the animated TV show.
He is, and he's got little hand suckers. He doesn't bite people, even though he's got the fangs. God damn it. No, I like that, you know, you can see him murdering guards in that hallway where he first came in, with all the, like, hieroglyphics on the walls and the Latin and everything, and, yeah, just reusing the set that way, and I appreciate...
Who's your favourite hunter?
I mean, Jovan, culturally. I have to stay loyal. I think they're all pretty good, to be honest.
I mean, there's the I like the ones that they actually fight in the maze. The two that kind of like are hanging around at the end, where like they're just the heavies at the end.
We've got Azarol and Barrasso are the two that survive to the end, I believe.
Yes, and they're kind of like, they're fine, but like they're definitely not like the most fun of all of them.
No, yeah. I mean, I appreciate the resisting the urge to have like. Here's a Wakandan, here's a, you know, like tying them all explicitly to groups we've seen before. Like, I think we've got too many Easter eggs and cutesy things at this point. So I appreciate them, just have fun with it. Here are just four or five distinct hunter designs kind of thing. Yeah, there isn't a lot to it. Like, we've basically talked for the runtime of the damn thing, and a lot of that was explaining where these characters come from in comics, but... I just appreciate, and also I forgot to mention, you know, that Michael Giacchino comes in, and like, this is a fucking composer. He has directed literally two, I think, short films or something.
This is like the second thing he's directed, I think, where he did the order. He did a short film in 2018 called Monster Challenge. He did one of the Star Trek short treks in 2019. This is his first kind of like thing longer than the short. And then immediately after this is announced and comes out, he is signed on as the director and composer of Them, which is obviously a remake of the Giant Ant movie from the 1950s.
I just... For him to come in and not to dismiss short film work and short episode work, but basically his first thing, and do something more visually interesting and more finely crafted than seasoned filmmakers have done. Like, embarrassing for them, I think.
It's so funny to think that the first thing I would have heard his score work on would have been the Medal of Honor games in the early 2000s. Like, he is the in-house composer on the Medal of Honor games. He even does, like, the early Call of Duty games as well, or some of the early Call of Duty games. Gets signed on to do The Incredibles, and then basically from there, he's, like, the Pixar in-house guy. He's the J.J. Yeah. Abrams in-house guy, because obviously he does Lost, he does Alias. And then from there, I feel like he is now probably the, other than John Williams, maybe the best-known composer by name to, like, a normie, because, like, he's done the Marvel fanfare, he's scored the Batman, and he scored Jurassic World, and he scored all these Pixar movies, and he's the Spider-Man composer and all the rest of it. Like, he is so firmly well known at this point, and now he is in his 50s to making a late career pivot into directing as well,
and it seems like he's good at it. I just like that.
And, like, he definitely knows what he wants to do as well, because like, you look at what he's done, and it's like, he's done Monster Thing, Werewolf by Night, and Them are all like a straight line in terms of what his influences are, and I'm like, cool.
Also, don't think I didn't notice him picking up a little tip from his work on Mission Impossible, specifically, is it Ghost Protocol, where everything doesn't work?
Yes, it is.
Yes, and we have the bomb doesn't stick, and like, the little claw doesn't quite work right. Top marks. Yeah, so I mean, there it is, you know, as I said, Elsa ends up with the stone. You know, she survives the werewolf thing because he imprinted on her enough. He took her scent. It had only worked once before. Please tell me the one time it worked before in a future thing. Yeah, and she's got a mansion and she's got the bloodstone, so she's immortal. Sorry, one more thing I should mention. I do appreciate that, like, if you take a little bit of artistic liberty with technology, this could kind of work as something that happened in like the 50s or the 60s or something.
Obviously
the bomb, I don't know, but like, it feels like something that could be in a schlocky 60s spy movie where, like, oh, we have a tiny explosive that sticks to things kind of thing.
So I do have one thing to ask, is the ending where, so I like the first step of this, where Elsa is sat in the chair holding the bloodstone, and then the color comes back in, but it's kind of a very like saturated color that does
I appreciate that they do that, like, it comes back in, it feels like early Technicolor kind of.
Yes, 100%. But then I feel like they really hit it over the head by playing Over the Rainbow. Then you have the final scene with Ted and Jack, like, in color as well.
Yeah,
and I'm like, I didn't like that one as much. No, that's the thing, is like, it's obviously there is like the jokey MCU tack to this thing, and I'm like, no, I think you end with Elsa and the Bloodstone and having it look Technicolor, where versus this, where it's like, oh, it looks more like a classic Marvel thing, which kind of undercuts what you've done for the last.
Yeah, and we talked in Love and Thunder about how, like, it is such a cliche at this point to have black and white with one object in color, but I think again it works better here than it did in Thor. And again, I just can't say enough about how well I think it was shot compared to, like, you know, we're obviously not saying this is like, my one go-to example all the time is like, any random episode of Barry would melt the brains of people that only watch MCU stuff, just because there will be three shots in an episode that are like more complicated than anything Marvel tried to do. But like, by what has become Marvel standards, and that person is right, those things did used to look like movies in the sort of Phase One-ish era.
Very funny that the other discourse I saw this week was people looking at the blocking in Avengers, because obviously they hired a TV director to direct the Avengers, and he was kind of, again, like, the point that someone made was like, yeah, but like, when you're working on a TV show, you kind of think about the four shots you want to compose really nicely, and everything else is just kind of redundant.
Mm-hmm.
I still think Avengers is a masterwork, even if I do agree.
Yeah.
The blocking in that thing is really, really rudimentary, and the composition of shots is really, really rudimentary. It's still a magic trick that movie works.
Yes.
It definitely is not, like, Whedon upped his game massively between Avengers and Age of Ultron, and I do kind of hope that, like,
you give
Giacchino more to do, and he gets to up his game more from this. I mean, hell, I don't know why Marvel didn't give him Blade off the back of this. I know he's probably signed on to them, but like, you've just had this guy who's just done this thing, who's been like working for you for years, and you've let him go off to another company, and instead you're hiring, I can't even remember the name of the person they've signed on for Blade at this point, but like,
both of the names they've had of people who you're like, who? And like, this feels like one. I know we say it all the time, this one needs to be special, but I do think Blade does need to be pretty special given how seared into people's brains the visuals and style of Blade, the original trilogy, are.
Neander Manch, who is directed like Top Boy in 71, so he's done some stuff. He directed like Lovecraft Country, which I don't know whether or not like they wanted to find someone who'd worked with Jonathan Majors, but like, it's definitely not like a super super exciting name. And I can't remember the name of the person who dropped out the first one, but again, it was a similar kind of like early in their career pull kind of thing. And obviously Giacchino's still that, but like, we've known Giacchino for a while and he's made something stylized and something interesting, and it's like, I'd rather see him get a shot rather than continually going to people who haven't really had time to kind of like establish a visual palette all of their own. And I like the stuff that the Blade, like, I like Dead Set, which he directed.
Oh, I like that.
From the director of the... Yeah. But again, like, the whole thing with Dead Set is it's kind of filmed in the style of Big Brother. Right, so it's like, it's not... Yeah, so it's not really...
You're riffing.
So
yeah, I mean, you know, just to bring this full circle, like, I just think this is a shot in the arm, stylistically. I'm not under the illusion that it's going to convince them to suddenly start building real sets and stuff like that. They are not going to get away from the thing that made them a billion-dollar powerhouse with all their green screen shit. But for me, it's like everything is in some way compromised, and like, even the stuff I like, there's something about it. I'm like, ugh. And this is just, ugh. This was just fun. This was a fun evening to watch this. And I've seen it 3 times, and I've enjoyed every single time. So I would love if future specials were like this, but as you say, there is some doubt if we'll even get many more specials, and also the second one sure did suck.
So I think we got something very important to do now.
We do.
Matthew.
Yes.
Convince me why Gael Garcia Bernal should be on the All-Marvel list.
Convince me why he should not.
I want your pitch first before
The dog acting, basically. I think he's actually genuinely really good, but I think he's also doing well with the compassionate, you know, when he's trying to help her with her injury and he's talking solemnly about his mysterious past, and you know, there is a weight that you can see on this man who changes against his will. But then he's also able to inject that levity here, and, you know, he's doing a couple of little jokes. I think it's great. Like, it's a very physical performance. A lot of Marvel is just quips, and to get to do something slightly more interesting than that, I think merits reward. There's also the fact we've got like fucking something like 4 picks to play with, or 3 at this point. So I can't remember how many we've got, but
we have a few that are floating around, and so this is just like, will we finally get someone off of maybe Parler and actually do a definitive, like, they are on the list.
I feel better about him being on than, I don't know, give me people from the maybe part, Christian Bale.
Christian Bale, Oscar Isaac, Charlie Cox.
Yeah, I feel better about him in this than I do any of them in their things. I think there is something compromised or an asterisk next to every one of those performances, whereas I feel this guy nailed what they asked him to do. He also is playing the werewolf, and you know, the costume may not be amazing, but like, you know, there is a physicality about, and some of it is probably stunt work and CG and blah blah blah, but like, the elements where like, that is actually him, it's like, good on you, you came and you gave a physical performance, and I would like to recognize that.
My whole thing just comes back to, I kind of wish there was more meat to this character, and I just needed a little bit more, and just in terms of like what his motivations are, because I feel like I don't want to say the movie or the special kind of slow rolls him being a werewolf. Like, it feels like it's supposed to be a little bit of a surprise when he does turn into a werewolf.
Sure.
And I'm like, I kind of wish, like, obviously they foreshadow it and stuff like that. But
I think that's my thing, is I think his performance is, you're getting little hints from how that are coming from him. Not just this. I mean, I guess you can write in the script, he scratches his ear and he walks in a circle before sitting down, and you know, stuff like that. But I just think the way he plays that role, And he's got, you know, he's got very kind eyes, he's very sympathetic, nice boy. I just think we need a wholesome, nice little torn werewolf man on our list.
I mean, I love Bernal.
Uh-huh.
It should come as no surprise to anyone who knows me listening to this podcast that one of my favorite movies is Y Tu Mama Tambien. Uh-huh. Like horny queer vibes from that movie. like my introduction to like most of the world, the introduction to Diego Luna and Bernal in that movie jerking off over a swimming pool. Like, indeed. It's very hard for you to get that image out of your brain. Obviously, also in like
bad it can be formative for some people.
Could be formative for some people. You got bad education? No. Like, just like, I really liked him in Old as one of the sole Old defenders in the world. He's in Station 11,
okay,
which is obviously a fantastic miniseries. I didn't get that like magic from him. I'm not. You're obviously really passionate about this performance. I don't want to like harsh on it.
I mean, I'm not saying it's one of the very best ones ever, and I know, and to some extent, the whole point of all Marvel is these are the best ones ever. But like, if we take it in a vacuum of like, in this project, was there a person who was giving a really great performance? And I think he was, personally. Like, I feel unapologetically good about this as a project, and I think he's good in it. And it's a, you know, it's a three-hander, essentially. Four, if you want to include a monster. I understand it's not a slam dunk. Absolutely write his name on the list in pen. I'm happy for him to be on in pencil, and we can have some arguments later. I also don't want to end... I don't want to come to the end of this slate of episodes and still have, like, four picks going spare because we're like, maybe, about so is, many people.
My question is like, is that because we now reached a point where, like, the material, the material isn't there to kind of like offer this thing, and like we have to reach back more into the early days of Marvel, like, for like, is there an argument that like when we get to the end of it, like, do we actually need to go back and go like, maybe Renner does need to be on this for Hawkeye?
Sure,
kind of thing. Like, does Simu Liu need to be on for Shang-Chi? Like, when we've got these picks and stuff like that, if we do say that he is on this list, I might come back to ask for a pick that I'm more passionate about than you. would be my caveat.
I am happy, as I said, to write him in pencil, knowing that next week is the end of our little run and there will be names to give out, and if it becomes a tight squeeze, I'm happy for him to be the first one who drops off. But I personally feel better about the people from this year who we've got in the maybe pile. You make a good point. There are probably people who we have shunned in previous years who have a stronger case than the likes of Oscar Isaac and Charlie Cox, purely because that Charlie Cox performance is like, well, it's a one-off, he's probably going to be way better, we're talking about his legacy in general, it's a one episode thing in a like otherwise somewhat compromised show, you know. So yeah, I mean, maybe we do that, maybe I would like to put somebody on this damn list.
I'm happy to put Bernal on, but we'll circle back to it to see whether
I'm happy for him to be in the metaphorical drop zone of when it gets, you know, when the arguments begin, he's the first one who we have to push off the boat. Which, yeah, anyway. So, in pencil, in very light font, barely legible, Kyle Garcia Bernal as Jet Russell. A hilarious name for that character. It was a different time. Anyway, and I guess villains, I mean, Verusa Bloodstone is kind of fun. The hunters are kind of fun. It's not that kind of thing.
I would almost, I think the reason why this does work is I think all three of those lead performances kind of like do add something to it. I just don't know if they add enough to have it be all Marvel. As I said at the top, like Harriet Sampson Harris's performance in Licorice Pizza is wonderful. I know Blank Check like really, really stumped for that on their year-end awards. It's just this fantastic kind of like weird energy performance as I can't remember if it's the manager or no, the agent for Cooper Hoffman's character is just really fun, really kind of like specific. And then seeing her in this getting to be kind of like very 1950s kind of like Hammer horror villain was a lot of fun.
Cracked in the head operating her animatronic husband.
Yes.
Yeah. inexplicably, we've gone for almost an hour, probably after editing, given how short this thing is, and we've gone almost as long as we do for the movies. But hey, that's how it goes. As I said, next week, there will probably be many All Marvels to give out. We've already said we are not doing a Guardian special, so next week will be our final project that we're covering.
Yeah, we might do another episode the discussion on All Marvel at the end of this to kind of,
yeah,
like,
we need to catch up on where we're at. Like, we bring it up each episode, but the list is now so big it's not practical to read it out every single time like we used to. So I think we need to just kind of clean that up, go through everyone who's on, sort out some of these maybes, all of that kind of thing. But next week,
and then once we've done with recording and editing, actually write the damn article up and put it up on the website, yeah. Because goddamn, when you look at the stats on the website, you guys fucking love listicles.
Yeah, people love controversy. Anyway, but yes, next week, many All Marvels will be given out as we, well, maybe not that many, but much discussion will be had. Wakanda Forever. Black Panther Wakanda Forever is next, and it will be the last thing we cover for this volume, season, however you want to phrase it.
It is a shame, as of to date the recording of this, and to kind of like put the date on like when we have to be done with recording of this mini-series because of real-life commitments that we may or may not have. We will not know whether or not Angela Bassett has won an Oscar when we record.
I mean, I can tell you before we record it, she's getting on the fucking list, but what? We can have some fun talking about it anyway. That's next week. And this has been Werewolf by Night. I've been Matt Waters. I've been joined by Ben Phillips. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Matt. Remember, everyone, read Next Wave.
Read Next
Wave. That is your homework for next week.
You know what? I might read Next Wave on a plane. And as always, Excelsior.
Excelsior.